everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of Cake Bites. With me on today's episode is Warren Davis. If his name doesn't necessarily ring a bell, you may recognize a little title he worked on called Qbert. I had so much fun getting to sit down and talk to Warren at the Let's Play Expo in Dallas over the summer. We talked a lot about Qbert, obviously, but I'm excited for you guys to listen to everything that Warren had to say, related to games or not. So, without further ado, here is Warren Davis.
The first time I saw myself was on a big screen. I did a feature film as an independent feature film in Chicago, and I was one of the leads, and it got screened at the Art Institute. So, I mean, it was like a major big screen, and it was weird. It was just weird.
Yeah.
But I've also been with friends of mine who are in movies, gone to see the movie with them the first time they've seen themselves up on the big screen, and that's been fun. But yeah, it's just weird. It's uncomfortable. Sometimes I watch myself and I go, oh, I'm giving a good performance. I'm okay with that. And then other times I'm watching, I'm going like, oh God, you know, I just look horrible. I just look absolutely horrible. But you just have to suck it up, you know, because that's your job.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to like it. You just have to suck it up. I know actors who just never watch themselves. They just can't do it because it bothers them too much.
Yeah. I've heard of some that have never watched anything they've ever been
That's right,
in. And
yeah.
I feel like that would be so... I feel like that would be difficult.
Well, I learn from it. You know, like if I see myself and I feel, okay, you're doing something weird or you're not aware of the camera in some way. So I learn every time. Every opportunity I have to watch myself, I will watch myself. And no matter how painful it is, I will watch myself and then learn something from it.
And you said you acted before you worked in games and did anything with games, right?
Yeah, because I was in college and I never had any desire to be an actor. And when I was in college, a friend of mine, I was doing radio in college. I had a radio show. And then a friend of mine wanted to start doing like radio comedy bits. So we did that. And he was interested in acting. He dragged me to an audition for a play, and I got cast. So here I've like never acted in my life. Didn't know anything about it. It was called The Ritz by Terrence McNally.
Uh-huh.
Really funny play. Very funny play. It's about a... A guy, I mean, it was on Broadway. It was about a guy who was like a witness to a mob murder. And to get away from the mob, he hangs out at a gay bathhouse in New York City. And he has to just sort of like lay low. And then, you know, like the mobster finds him. It's a farce. It's just a hysterically funny play. And it was made into a movie, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in like the 1960s. But it was originally a stage play. Anyway, I had so much fun doing this. And there was the curtain call that was really the best part. You came out, you did this stuff, and you were just being silly, and then you came out and you took a bow, and the audience is applauding and throwing roses at you and shit. It's like, wow, I could learn to like this.
So I could get used to it.
Yeah, I can get used to this. So, but I only did, I didn't study it really, that was in my undergrad, and then I went on and I got my graduate degree, but I always did community theater. Like wherever I lived, I would find a community theater group, and I would do plays, again, just for fun. I never took it seriously. But it was when I quit my first engineering job that I moved into Chicago, and I said, I'm going to start studying at Second City. I had seen some Second City improv comedy shows, and I thought, I can do that. So I asked where you learn this improv comedy thing, and there was only one school at the time that was teaching it, and I started studying there. And it was while I was a student there that I was unemployed, and I looked in the Sunday paper, and I got the job at Gottlieb. So all the time I was developing Qbert, I was taking improv classes at night, and when I was done with it was a one-year program, and when I was done with that one-year program, which probably would have been around the fall of 1982, which is just about when Qbert was getting produced and you know, rolling off the line, I finished my studying and got together with some of my classmates, and we formed an improv group, and we would do shows around town at different clubs. And I think we did that for about a year. And then I was kind of got tired of the improv scene, and I wanted to learn a real acting technique. And there was a place in Chicago called the Lois Hall Studio, and it was a two-year Meisner Technique program, and I joined that. So,
what type of time commitment was that for you over the course of 2 years?
It was, I think, once a week. It was once a week class, but you'd do some work in between, either studying lines for a scene or something. But mostly it was just mostly just the class. And I do remember rehearsing with scene partners outside of class. You know, we'd get together between classes to work on scenes. So yeah, it wasn't much of a commitment. And then I think I was also doing theater. I auditioned for plays and would do plays.
Yeah, just around in Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah. And I was doing that all the time. I was making games my entire time.
Did you move to Chicago for the improv opportunity? Or
yeah. What? So my job that I had out of school took me to Illinois because I went to school in upstate New York.
Okay.
My first job was with Bell Laboratories in suburban Illinois and Naperville, Illinois. And I enjoyed it for a while, but that job had me traveling a lot.
Yeah.
So I'd be there for a couple of months, then I would go someplace for more months. Then I'd be back for a few months and then travel again for months. And I kind of got tired of not having a home.
Yeah.
And they had given me a sort of a side job once where I was doing some early speech recognition work in a research and development group that was fun. But then they pulled me out of there and put me back on this other group that had me traveling. And I was like, I don't want to travel again. But that was what they assigned me, and I quit. First of many times I quit a job because I wasn't happy with what they were asking me to do. So that when I quit was September of 1981, and I had been going into Chicago on the weekends, and that's where I went to Second City shows and learned about Second City. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go into Chicago and I'm going to start studying improv.
And did you know at the time that Chicago was a mecca for game development?
No, not at all.
Because I'm not sure if people realize that generally
either,
that modern day pinball was developed in Chicago by one person. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I mean, you had Gottlieb, Williams, I mean, everybody was there.
Yeah.
When you started at Gottlieb, you said that the video division that you were working in was brand new.
That's right.
Yeah?
Yeah. So what had happened at Gottlieb was, you know, they were a little late to the game. You know, I think everybody else was, even the big pinball manufacturers were making video games.
Yeah.
But Gottlieb, which was a family-run company until about 1977 when they were bought by Columbia Pictures. So Gottlieb is now owned by Columbia, and they decided to start a video division in the late 1970s. Their first thing, they licensed a couple of Japanese games, so they didn't have an in-house team making games. And I think that was sometime around 1977, 78, something like that, maybe 79. It was the late 1970s. They licensed two games. One was called New York, New York. And the other one was called, I can't remember.
Racking your brain.
Yeah, it'll come to me later. I have it written down someplace. But there were two games, and I don't think they did particularly well, but at some point, Gottlieb decided to have an in-house team, and so they hired two guys to start this team. One was Howie Rubin. He was the VP of Business Development, and the other was Ron Waxman. He was the VP of Engineering, and they had a secondary plant. So the main plant was in Northlake, but they had a secondary plant in Bensonville, which is right behind O'Hare in this industrial park, kind of a nondescript building. It was a little smaller than their main plant. And there were some offices in there, and they started up a video division.
Wow.
Now, I wasn't part of it at the very, very beginning, because they had been going for maybe a year, maybe two. They were working on a couple of different things. I remember there was an Apple II-based game called Quizimodo that was like a quiz game.
Okay.
And there was a pinball game with a video monitor in it called Caveman.
So that pretty unique for pinball?
That was pretty unique. I think it was the first time a video monitor had been put in a pinball. And I believe they made those. That was produced. And they also hired a guy named Tim Skelly, who had a track record. He was like a superstar.
Yeah.
He had made a whole bunch of games for Cinematronics that were big hits. And they needed, I guess, a kind of guru to sort of shepherd this new fledgling group into existence. To sort of guide them, you know,
okay.
Yeah. So Tim was hired just to do a game. That game became Reactor, which is actually on the floor here at Let's Play. And I got hired in January of 1982. And so, you know, this is after Pac-Man. This is after Donkey Kong. And I'm hired, you know, knowing nothing about video games. And
were you a programmer? Was there,
yeah.
That was what you did prior?
That's right. So I have a master's in electrical engineering. With a, you know, sort of an interest in computer programming. So I was basically a hardware/software engineer at the time. I'd been doing some hardware engineering as well. Once I started in video games, I just became strictly a software engineer, and that was fine by me. January of 1982, Reactor was just sort of, I guess, in the midst of development.
Mm-hmm.
So Tim was there. There was a handful of programmers. Maybe Jeff Lee was the only artist. I don't know that there was another artist working on video games. He pretty much supplied art for every game, I think. Tim Skelly also was an artist, so he kind of did his own art. So there were some games where the people did their own art because they could. But the few programmers there, I don't even remember the number, but it was very small. And it was kind of a think tank, kind of a big open room. It wasn't cubicles. It was just sort of tables. We didn't have enough development systems to go around. We had to share them. It was an interesting time. And Howie and Ron were both characters. Ron, very large, rotund guy with a very gruff voice and demeanor. And just, you know, he would look at you and you thought he hated your guts. But, you know, he didn't, you know, necessarily. He didn't suffer fools, that's for sure. But he was a sweet guy. And then Howie was just crazy, out-of-the-box thinker. Howie was a guy that would come in the middle of the day and say, hey, everybody, stop what you're doing. We're going to go play football in the plant. Because the plant was empty. There was this big manufacturing plant that wasn't being used. Just all this empty space. So it was a big building, as most of these buildings were. All of the, you know, Williams was the same way, Gottlieb's main plant. They had a big manufacturing facility where they could set up production lines to build the machines. And then they had, like, off in a corner, they'd have a set of offices. So we would, obviously, our offices would be, you know, in the building, but separate from the plant. But he would, you know, Howie would come in and say, hey, stop what you're doing. We're going to throw the football around. So that's what we would do. And it was a great time. So then what happened was, and I worked as a junior programmer on another game. I was sort of a supplemental programmer to another guy who was working on his game. I learned a little that way.
Did that game release?
No, that name never got released, although a little side note, it just, like a year ago, they found the ROMs and they recreated it into a cabinet and is sitting on the floor at the Galloping Ghost Arcade in Illinois, outside of Chicago. Doc Mack and Jeff Lee, who was the graphic artist for it, and Tom Malinowski, who was the programmer, all worked together to make that happen. So they actually, there's a working cabinet of this game.
Did they give it a name?
It was it was originally called Protector, I believe, was the first name. And then when that didn't test very well, they put it out with a different name, Guardian. And when that didn't work, they put it out with another name, Video Man. And its final name, which always puzzled me, was Argus. So I used to call it ProVidGuard Argus because, you know, it's just the name, and the name didn't seem to matter what it was. It never tested that well for some reason. Anyway, but they recreated it last year. Anyway, so so after I did a few things for that game, then it was like, well, make your own game. And it was okay. Well, there really was no pressure. That was the thing. It was just like, make a game. And that was the environment we had. There was no pressure. It was just play.
Yeah.
Do whatever you wanted. Howie and Ron were smart enough to know that they didn't know what made a good video game. And they hired people to just experiment and try to make a game. So the way Kubert got started, I mean, I just saw a bunch of hexagons that were shaded in such a way they looked like cubes. They were filling the screen. And another programmer, Kan Yamamoto, had them up on his workstation. And he was doing something with them, not using them just, I think, as a placeholder, as a piece of art on the screen. But I thought, you know, if you shape that as a pyramid and you dropped a ball on the top, it would have one of two choices which way to bounce. Well, two choices to a programmer is a bit, 0 or 1. And you put enough bits together, you get a byte. And it occurred to me that with one random byte, I could determine the path of a ball from the top to the bottom. So it was really just a programming exercise for me to learn how to program randomness and gravity. And once I had a ball bouncing on this pyramid, I was like, well, maybe I should have a player character bouncing around. So I had the player character. I went to Jeff Lee, the artist, and I said, do you have any characters I could use? And he put up a bunch of characters that he had come up with. And I was like, I'll use this orange guy here with the big nose. And, you know, Jeff designed that character with the notion of him shooting stuff out of his nose. He thought that would be funny. And it is funny, but to me, it was too complicated because I was too new and I just didn't know how to do that. I was like, maybe I should keep it simple.
You were thinking jumping.
Jumping, yeah. I just want to have the guy jump, hop. So I put that in. And then once Ron Waxman had this habit, like he'd hang around late at night and he'd sit behind you. Like I'd be sitting, you know, I'm just playing around. I'd be working late one night. He would just be sitting behind you. Breathing. You could hear him breathing. And he always had a cigar. He's smoking a cigar and just breathing. You know, it's almost like Darth Vader sitting behind you. But I'm just, you know, ignoring it. I got used to it. And I was playing around. I had my guy hopping around. The balls are bouncing. And Ron goes, what if the colors change when he bounces on a cube? I go like, Suddenly the game had a goal. I was like, okay, that's what it was missing. It was missing a goal. And then that was such a fantastic, I was like, yes. So I implemented that. And the whole development of Qbert just continued like that. It was sort of like, what's next? What do we do next? What's the next thing that makes sense?
Yeah.
And Jeff was a fantastic collaborator. I trusted him and his ideas. He came up with a lot of ideas that end up in the game. Came up with some that didn't, but and Dave Thiel, you know, I went to him. I needed sounds, and you know, he came up with basically the soundscape. Some of the things were ideas that I had, and I said, I want something like this or I want something like that, and he would do it. And then other things he came up with on his own. The speech, Qbert's speech, was Dave Thiel. You know, basically being annoyed with this speech chip we had on our soundboard. It just, no matter what you made it say, it just sounded terrible. It was very ma, not don, and they, you know. So he had the idea of just putting in random phonemes. So instead of actually speaking, it's just literally random sounds coming out of the speech chip, and it's great. And then, you know, the cartoon balloon and all this stuff, it was just, it all just sort of synergized.
Did it test well?
It tested very well.
Did you have to change anything after the first test?
The thing I changed most was the tuning of it. And because it was my first game and I didn't really know how to tune a game, most people were telling me it was too hard. But there were things I stuck to my guns with. I did make it easier after testing, after focus groups, after in-house testing, just people in the office playing it. I kept making it easier, but there were things I stuck to my guns. Like a lot of people wanted me to change the orientation of the joystick. Like to me, it's absolutely obvious when you look at the pyramid, you have one of two choices to jump. If you're at the top, or if you're in the middle, you have four choices, and they're all diagonals.
Yeah.
So it makes total sense. But people were, like, floored by this notion of a joystick that only had four diagonals. And I couldn't understand that. But they were like, no, it's got to be up, down, left, right. And I'm like, well, look at the play field. You can't go up, down, left, right. So a lot of people pressured me, but I stuck to my guns on that. You know, right now, and you know, when you play the game, if you're standing anywhere on the edge, you could jump right off the pyramid and die. And a lot of people didn't like that because they did it. And I thought this is something you're going to learn to not do.
Yeah.
And it's an added challenge. But a lot of people are like, no, that people are going to jump off and die and they're going to hate the game.
It's like you put another quarter in and
well,
you
that's
learn
right.
a lesson.
That's right. Well, that's what happened. And you don't know if somebody's frustrated. Are they going to come back or are they not going to come back? So I didn't want to change it, but we put it out on test in the arcade, and I watched. I watched people play. And indeed, people did. They came up. Some people literally put in a quarter and just pushed the joystick and jumped off 3 times in a row. And they walked away.
And going to have it, but that's not your fault.
Well, it is in a way. I mean, if nobody, here's the thing. Nobody plays the game, if people put a quarter in and walk away and don't come back, then the game doesn't collect quarters. And if the game doesn't collect quarters, then people don't want to buy it. And if people don't want to buy it, then we can't build it. And then we, as a manufacturer of these games, you know, go out of business. So you, that's what, it's not a, like a malicious capitalistic kind of a, yes, these games are designed to suck your quarters. It's not that so much as, you know, we want them to be popular. We want them to be played so that people want to buy them. People in the arcades, the arcade owners and distributors want to buy them, and then we can build them, and then we stay in business.
So video games now are mass-produced prior, you know, because they're not making entire cabinets.
Right.
I mean, as far as cabinet production went, were there numbers of cabinets made, or was it more based on people's interest in buying it? Because I can imagine it's just, they're so big, and there's so many parts involved.
Well, I mean, this was our business. You know, we made pinball machines, and then we made video games. And pinball machines and video games both come in big cabinets. They're costly, so they're not generally designed for consumers. They're designed for a particular customer, distributors and arcade owners and bar owners and such. So, you know, the economics of it really weren't any different from pinball, which had been around forever. So they knew that business. But video games, you know, that was the purpose of our business, was to sell those cabinets. That's what we did. We built them and sold them. Now, there were such things as kits, and everybody realized that, you know, if a video game is out there and the cabinet is out there and the game, you know, suddenly becomes, you know, it's lived through its life cycle, so now people aren't playing it so much. It would be nice if we could put another game in that same cabinet. So you don't have to supply the cabinet. You can supply a new marquee, some new artwork, a new control panel, maybe a new board, or maybe just the ROMs in a board. And, you know, we could still sell it and make a profit, but it would be a lot cheaper than buying a whole cabinet, and that would make it attractive to people who already own arcades. So then there became a kit market, and that became a whole nother, you know, we still needed and wanted to sell full units. So then we would, you know, design different cabinets for different games. Sometimes we designed sit-down cabinets, like Mach 3 was a flying game. We had a cockpit-style cabinet. We also had those cocktail cabinets. I don't know if you remember those. For bars, it was basically a small thing with a flat glass top and the monitor facing up. So you would play head-to-head if you were playing two-player, or you could just sit down and play. And we call those cocktail tables.
Yesterday, John Newcomer, who made Joust, he joined us for lunch yesterday, which was amazing. You surprised the crap out of me yesterday with your message. You were like, I hope it's okay. And I was like, never in a million years did I say, no, definitely not. But he had a really good question for you yesterday. He asked, you know, in Q-Bert, when you die, you get that tapping sound, you know, and how did you guys come up with that?
Right. Yes, the knocker. So this was the idea of a guy named Rick Tai, and he was one of our engineering technicians. And, you know, the game had been in development. It was pretty far along, and he was playing it, and he said, you know what would be cool? And by the way, a lot of people said that to me a lot while I was developing it. Everybody had an idea. So, you know, I was kind of a filter to say, yes, this is a good idea. No, this is not a good idea. But he came to me and said, you know what would be cool? If you had a pinball knocker, it's a standard item in a pinball machine that just it's a little piston that pushes against the end of the wood of the cabinet, make a knocking sound. He said, what if you had, because Q-Bert falls off the pyramid, he goes, you know, if you had a knocker down there that went off when he, like, landed. And I thought, that's a pretty cool idea. So we put it in, and we tried it, and I didn't like the sound of it, because it sounded too much like a knock, like knocking on the door. And I thought, what we really want is the sound of, like, a body, like a sack of potatoes hitting, a thud. So we thought about it, and we thought, okay, well, maybe if we put a little piece of foam, and this might have been Rick's idea, too, to put a little piece of foam right at the spot where the knocker hits the wood to sort of soften the sound a little bit. We tried it, and it sounded fantastic. It was amazing. I loved the sound. It was, like, perfect. And it really was like this illusion because he goes, and then it just sounds like a body is hitting the bottom of the cabinet. We really got a kick out of it. So we went to management. We said, oh, this is we got to have this. Yeah. And they said, well, we can put the knocker in, but, you know, putting that piece of foam, it's just, it's very labor intensive because you got to put it right in the right spot. And it's hard to do and probably add like $15 to the cost of the game. We're not going to do it. So they said no, but it did go out with the knocker.
And people, do you have a lot of people comment on the knock?
Oh yeah, always. Even from the very beginning, people loved that feature. People loved that because you're not expecting it. You don't expect something like that. So it was a bit of a surprise.
Would you say Qbert is your favorite game you got to develop, or?
Wow, that's a tough one.
It may be your most famous game, but that doesn't mean it has to be your favorite.
That's
game,
true. That's know? True. I would say it probably is not. I think maybe Us Versus Them.
Yeah.
Is my favorite game. Us Versus Them was a Laserdisc game that unfortunately suffered from, you know, it came out right as the Laserdisc craze crashed. And Laserdiscs were discovered to not be too reliable in the field. And it's unfortunate because it tested through the roof. I was very proud of this game. All the guys that worked on it, we were all very proud of it. It was a bit of a groundbreaking game. And if you look at it today, you know, it had things like cutscenes with live actors. Mm-hmm. It had different points of view at each level. You were, you know, the camera was a different point of view with filmed backgrounds and just a great variety of gameplay. I think it was a very engaging game. And like I said, it tested great. Gottlieb was poised to build the shit out of these things, and then this big crash happened, and suddenly nobody wanted a Laserdisc game because they just weren't reliable in the field. So I think I'm most proud of that game. I mean, I am certainly proud of Qbert. Us Versus Them is probably the game I'm most proud of.
Yeah. How about least proud of?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think
not to disparage on any project.
No, of course not. I made, in my career, 7 arcade games.
Yeah.
And I think maybe probably the one I wouldn't say the least proud, but maybe the most disappointed with.
There you go.
Was Exterminator. Exterminator and Qbert are probably the two games that I can take the most personal credit for, that they were my vision, I would say, yeah. You know? Because all the other games I did were either somebody else's idea or collaborating with people, you know? Us Versus Them, the concept came from Dennis Nordman. Lotto Fun was a redemption game, and that was Harry Rubin had the idea, and I just basically implemented it. Joust 2 was John Newcomer. So I think Exterminator, I was disappointed in because just a lot of things conspired to make it fail, and I think the idea of it was sound, but it didn't work out. And, you know, I guess I'm most disappointed. I actually played it. It's such a rare game. I think they made 250 cabinets, so that's all, yeah. It's a long story. There were some noise problems with the hardware, and we had engineered or had hired a company to engineer a new controller. The controller just needed to do, like, everything. It needed to rotate. It was a joystick that needed to rotate with a thumb button, but also needed to move in all directions, and anyway, wow. it was a lot, but there were problems with the original engineering of that, and all these problems got solved, but too late.
Oh.
It's like they sort of rushed it out, and they didn't fix the problems first, and it just then got a bad reputation. But I played the game at a show like a year ago, and I was like, oh, this game isn't so bad, you know, the actual fun of it, I was actually like, oh, well, it's pretty cool. So it's not that I'm the least proud of it, I think I'm just the most disappointed.
And then, so you said 7 games you can credit.
Yeah.
Is that including USSA?
No, I didn't include that because that never got released. So, yeah, USSA was this game that John Newcomer and I were working on. It was going to be...
And you were working at Williams at this time?
This was at Williams, yeah. And Eugene Jarvis had been gone but came back. And under his tutelage, we developed a 256-color arcade system, which was a first of its kind, and it was a small staff back then because after the crash of 84, a lot of people either quit or were let go, and I was like hired after that at Williams, and so there was just enough for 2 teams. So 2 teams started to develop separate games. John Newcomer and I were developing USSA, which is an overhead view tank game just like the classic tank game, but with photorealistic graphics.
Yeah.
And the difference was that the player was driving a 4x4 truck with a missile launcher in the flatbed. And once you launched a missile, and you drove the truck with a steering wheel, but once you launched the missile, you steered the missile with the steering wheel. I thought it was an awesome game. I really enjoyed it. And it looked fantastic.
You said John went and bought models.
John bought all of these model kits of, like, suburban homes, 7-Eleven, McDonald's, and he built these, he painted these. They looked absolutely real and flawless. And then we shot them with a video camera from above, and then composited them into a suburban landscape. We shot, like, you know, grass textures and road textures. And John was the artist for that game. He created all this art. It looked fantastic. And I was the programmer. And together, we designed it. So it was, we were very proud of it. But unfortunately, there were two teams working at the same time. The other team was Eugene Jarvis and Jack Hager and George Petro, and they were making a game that became NARC.
Well, there you go.
And at some point, you know, USSA was canceled, and so it never saw the light of day.
So you said that you got hired at Williams kind of in the midst of the craft?
Well, you know, it was one thing after another. It was a few things, actually. So, I mean, Gottlieb... just unique to Gottlieb was the fact that I think, you know, Howie and Ron's method of just hiring a lot of people and letting them loose worked with a few games, but there was a lot of dead weight. There were a lot of people there who were not producing games and were not producing releasable games. So that was a problem.
At this point, was pinball still a viable market or had it really shifted to arcade?
Pinball was pretty much dead. I mean, not dead, like literally dead, but it had scaled back. They had scaled back their pinball production so much for video.
Yeah.
And I think there was a bit of a resentment from the pinball.
I mean, was there any divisiveness between the divisions at all? to get messy.
No. This is a story I love telling. I love telling the story because I think it's kind of funny. We were we were isolated over in Bensonville, and we all were pinball players. We idolized these pinball designers. You know, we just thought they were amazing. And so when we heard we were going to be moving into Northlake, we were all excited. We were like, okay, we're going to be side by side these pinball designers that we think are fantastic. So we move in. Management does nothing in the way of mixing us together, throwing a party, throwing a gathering, introducing us. Nothing. We literally show up one day in this big area that I think used to be the pinball area, and they were sort of pushed back into a corner or smaller area.
Oh, no.
Because, you know, from the pinball designer's point of view, video was the golden child, and they were being, you know, they were the ugly stepsister. And I think they were very resentful about that. They were also resentful that they weren't given the opportunity, I think, for them themselves to start making some video games. I think they would have liked to have had that opportunity, but management didn't allow it.
And that's interesting because you would think that with their experience already,
Well, I guess management did not think that designing a pinball game, which is mechanical, is the same skill as designing a video game, which I think is true, you know. But anyway, that's not to say they couldn't do it. Anyway, they mixed us all together, and we are just getting the stink eye from all these people. We're looking at these people, and we're smiling like, hi, and they're like... So it was really funny, and management did nothing to help that situation. But I think over time, as they got to know us and we got to know them, it all sort of worked itself out, and we were very harmonious. I mean, we did mutually respect each other.
For people who don't know that there was, quote, a video game crash in the 80s, what propelled that and really forced a market crash of
well,
that size?
The way I see it, there were two factors, okay? One was the growth of the industry. It grew so fast, so many arcades springing up that needed product, and then so many manufacturers who were building product, and... You know, for a while it was great, and it could sustain that growth because the product was good and video games were new and everything, you know, people were playing them. What happened was, you know, so many people jumped on the bandwagon and the need was so great that suddenly a lot of these games coming out were not good and the players weren't playing them. they so you now you have all this you have all this real estate in all these arcades filled with games that maybe you're not collecting. Well, and then you've got to pay for real estate if you're an arcade owner, and if your games aren't collecting, you fold or go out of business or whatever. And so it just became a glut of games, and I think it just grew too fast. It didn't grow and stabilize as it should have. And then I think the second factor was the Laserdisc. You know, I think that was a small part of it, was, you know, everybody got really excited about Laserdisc games and thought this was the future, and then it just turned out to be a fad because, you know, all of these games, yeah.
It proved unreliable.
Yeah, they proved unreliable in the field.
Because what did you say? People would hit, they would hit the side of the machine.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, because a Laserdisc player is not that much different from a record player. It's got a stylus and it's reading the disc. And if you smash the cabinet, the stylus would just jerk. You would lose sync. The game would not know where you are in the Laserdisc, and it didn't know what to do. The game would go wonky. The people would complain and ask for their money back. And when people realized that you could do that, then I think, you know, people would play a game for like 20 minutes and then, bang the side of the cabinet and say, give me my money back. So it was not a good thing for the industry. So I think, you know, and I think a lot of manufacturers invested a lot of money in Laserdiscs. So that became a thing. So I think the combination of those two things formed the crash in 1984, and a lot of smaller companies folded. It hurt a lot of the bigger, manufacturers. But the thing about the pinball industry is that it has always had its ups and downs. So these companies who've been doing pinball for years, they knew how to scale back the production line. They knew, they might have to lay people off, but they just knew how to survive with smaller productions. And they were very good at that. And so they withstood. Now Gottlieb, to talk about Gottlieb in particular, Gottlieb was bought by Columbia. Columbia was then bought by Coca-Cola. And I don't think Coca-Cola really understood the pinball industry or really wanted a pinball company when they bought Columbia Pictures. I don't think they wanted a pinball company. So I'm not sure when the writing on the wall happened, but some stuff was happening behind the scenes. We eventually, even though we were doing pretty well, we did have the problem with the distributor's lawsuit after the Laserdisc problem, but other than that, we had Qbert was a hit game, and Mach 3 was a huge hit game. We had had some lesser hits, there was Mad Planets and Three Stooges. So we had produced other games, but it was like September, I think, of 1984. We just walked into the office one day completely surprised to hear that we were closed.
That was what they said. We are closed.
We are closed. Ladies and gentlemen, I think Ron Waxman walked out into the big area where all of our cubicles were, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are closed for business."
Yeah. Iconic.
Yeah.
Can't forget that.
Well, it was a shock. And the thing is, we all knew something was up. We didn't know what. It was just a sort of a pall over the company for a few weeks. Because things, there was just a tension that we all felt, and we didn't understand it. And then we closed.
How long after that did you start working at Williams?
It was like a year and a couple of months. So it was early, I think it was like March of 1986. So I think September 1984 to March of 1986, I actually had another job out of the game industry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did it remind you why you wanted to, or did you want, how did you work for Williams then? If you had another job out of the industry, what took you back?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story too. So the day we were let go, the day we closed, part of the processing we went through was placement. Mm-hmm. So, they tried to give us leads on other jobs. And I don't know how this happened, but somehow some headhunter found out that we were closing. And so all of our phones were ringing with headhunters calling and saying, we'd like to place you here, we'd like to place you here. And there was this one place called Datalogix in downtown Chicago, River North section of downtown. And they were hiring. They were hiring graphics programmers, and that's what we were now. So me and one other guy from Gottlieb, Neil Bernstein, who had programmed Qbert's Cubes, the sequel to Qbert that I had nothing to do with, he got the job and told me about it. A headhunter called me. I took that job, and it was a fun job. There was a guy from Williams who worked there also, Ken Lance. So there were a bunch of us sort of former video game guys there. The interesting thing is about a year later, or yeah, a little over a year later, I got a phone call from another headhunter saying, hey, would you like to go back to video games? Williams is looking to hire. And I said, yes, absolutely. And I took, so I started Williams. I found out later that it was the same headhunter.
Really?
Using a different name. Because that's a little sketchy what he was doing there.
Absolutely.
But it was the same headhunter who got me into Datalogix, got me out of Datalogix. It's kind of funny.
And did you do anything with home consoles? Or was it really just arcade?
Only arcade until I moved to California. So
what is that?
I left the arcade industry in 1995. I left Williams and came to California, on and off. I actually kind of went back and forth for a year and a half, and Williams was very lovely. The manager guy there, Paul DeSalt, was very kind to let me continue to develop WTARG, my digitization system. So I continued to develop that sort of on the sly, you know, just a few hours a week. To give me a little bit of money while I was basically in Los Angeles scoping out that town for a move.
Yeah.
And so I did that for about a year and a half, and then I got hired by Disney. Disney Interactive hired me and paid for the move. So my family relocated from Chicago to Los Angeles, and I started making home games for Disney. Although I say making home games, although I was hired because they thought they were going to be making games in-house. But between the time I was hired and the time I moved there, there was a complete management shift. And they decided that they weren't going to make in-house games. So actually what I worked on at Disney were tools.
Oh, okay.
Software tools for art creation and things like that. But I did eventually work on a few titles in some capacity. I think it was a Mulan Story Studio and Tarzan Activity Center.
I didn't realize that you had worked for Disney Interactive, though.
Mm-hmm. For 4 years. And then I became an Imagineer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the entire...
Now we're in California, Anaheim? Oh.
Not Anaheim, no. Disney Interactive was in Glendale. They had a campus in Glendale. So they had a bunch of buildings all in the same area. Not too far from the studio. Like, we would go have lunch at the commissary on the Disney lot, which was nice. It was like maybe a mile and a half away. We were in a building. Oh, I was going to say, all the 4 years I was working for Disney Interactive, there were layoffs like every 6 months.
Really?
It was very
tumultuous.
It was tumultuous, but it was like overstuffed. There were like 500 employees or something when I started there. It was way too much. They had hired all this. They thought they had all this money to spend, and they pissed away hundreds of millions of dollars. Then there was a management change. So there were all these layoffs. Then there was a management change. So the top management got kicked out. New people came in. And they were more fiscally responsive. But even so, in 2000, I heard there was another... I survived every layoff. I don't even know how. But in 2000, there was another layoff, and I was told I probably would not be surviving that layoff.
Yeah.
And so the opportunity came up to transfer to Imagineering. And that was a dream of mine. I loved the idea of Imagineering. I loved Disney theme parks, and I was like, oh, my God, to be able to work on theme park rides, to me, was, you know, the ultimate. Sadly, that is not what I was working on. The division or the department of Imagineering I went to, division that was working on an online, massive multiplayer online game called Toontown. And
I played Toontown.
Yeah, and Toontown still is sort of being, I think Disney, you know, gave it off to
I think the servers shut down like within the last year.
Oh, is that right?
It was very, maybe 2 years. It's very recent that the servers closed down, but it was a big deal when they did because a lot of people were like, I played Toontown my whole childhood. It was the first multiplayer game I ever played. You know, my parents would let me play. So.
Well, I didn't last there very long. Unfortunately, I mean, they were really wonderful people, but they didn't give me anything to do. So, like, I was hired, and I was like, well, what should I do? Oh, just read some stuff. Read up on this stuff and read up on, and then, you know, whatever. And I literally spent weeks with nothing to do. And I don't work well that way. I really kind of need to have a goal.
Yeah.
So, you know, set me a goal. Give me a project. And they were always busy with a deadline or something. And so it was like, oh, we'll get to you tomorrow. Just do, you know, whatever you want. And I literally didn't do much while I was there. And I did not like that. I was very bored. And there was one project they gave me. I needed to port something that was... I needed to port, like, I guess, a library of graphics functions to DirectX. And that took me, like, 3 weeks to do. So, it you know... But I was there for 4 months. And that 3 weeks was the only time I felt like I was busy and had a goal. And eventually, I just quit. I just couldn't handle it. It was just not what I wanted. And then I had a variety of other games in the game industry. I went to mostly small studios and then went out of the game industry. I got myself a job at ILM, Industrial Light and Magic. Very excited to work there.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that is they were located in San Francisco, but I was located in Los Angeles, but they were looking for somebody in Los Angeles because they had developed Previz software, Previz being pre-visualization for movies, which is a fancy way of saying sort of like high-tech storyboarding with animation. It's basically storyboarding with animation. And so they developed a software for that, and they wanted to maybe have people down in L.A. start using that software, and they wanted somebody local to be the technical liaison. So that's what I did. It didn't work out the way they thought. They did one project, and... they didn't have the resources to be responsive to the needs of the special effects company. Like, yeah. They would request a lot of changes, and even though ILM tried to make as many changes as they could, you know, it was really kind of a workflow thing. ILM does a certain type of workflow, and the program was designed for that. The company, the special effects house that was using it in LA, had a different workflow, and it really wasn't conducive to their workflow, so it didn't really work out. And then I ended up staying on at ILM for a while, doing some software development off-site, but eventually they let me go. They laid me off, and I knew it was coming. It was a great time working there. I got no regrets. A few years later, when Disney bought Lucasfilm, they disbanded the whole R&D department at ILM, so I would have been let go then anyway. So.
And you mentioned a little bit ago your digitization system. And I'm not your digitization.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Digitization system.
Right. I know it's hard to say.
Yeah, very much so. I don't know.
Say it five times fast.
No. Yeah. No. And I mean, that system was used in a lot of, I mean, pretty famous games. Mortal Kombat, the NBA
Jam.
Jam series.
NBA Jam series, Mortal Kombat.
And how did that? I mean, how did that work? What did it do?
Well, you know, I was fascinated with the idea of digitizing, you know, video images as soon as the first digitizers came on the market, which was like 1986, maybe 1985. And they were crude and they were difficult to use, but I started playing with them at Williams just to see, really to see if there was something valid in them. But really, when the turning point that made them actually practical and usable was a thing called the Targa board that came out around 1986, I think. It was a PC board. You went into a slot in your PC, and you could plug a color video camera into it, and it would just grab a frame like that. You could, whatever you're pointing the camera at, would grab a frame, and you would have a true color image that frame. And I was like, okay, well, we can use this. The other thing about that board that was fantastic was it came with a software developer kit, which means that I could write a piece of software that could talk to that board and control that board. That was really the thing that made it usable. So I created a piece of software called WTARG. The W stood for Williams.
Yeah.
Williams Targa. And I started, you know, creating a way to grab digitized images. And it was very, it was artist intensive. So in order to get motion, you had to videotape somebody with like a VHS camera, and then you'd have to play that videotape and pause the videotape. You have to freeze frame the videotape. And I don't know if you've ever tried doing that. You get a lot of noise and jittery. It's very difficult. And then you'd grab that thing and you'd get some image, and then you would have to strip out manually all of the background with some art tool. And you had to do that for literally every frame of animation you wanted. And, you know, the image, like I said, was noisy, so you'd have to clean up the image, and it was very artist-intensive. But I continued to develop that until I left, and I left it in a state, it was still not that great when I quit Williams after USSA. And then when I came back 3 years later for Terminator 2, I was like stunned to find they're still using the same system.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the computers had gotten faster. I just assumed somebody would be, you know, continuing to improve that system. Nobody had touched it. So I got the latest Targa board, which now had chroma key built in. Chroma key, of course, you know, strips out the background automatically. You don't have to do anything. And like I said, computers were faster, memory was more plentiful, so I was able to grab more images in real time and do a lot more things with them to facilitate getting, like, a whole animation. So it got to the point where, like, Revolution X with Aerosmith, we could literally, and Williams had designed, Jack Hager had a hand in designing this blue screen studio.
Yeah.
And so we got cameras, great cameras, lighting, and a computer setup. We could point a camera at Aerosmith, you know, Steven Tyler at a microphone doing a kick or some move, and we could literally, in real time, grab, you know, 15, 20 frames of that, strip out the background, and create a palette for it automatically,
yeah,
and put it on our hardware in like a minute or two. So it was a really cool system. It's a great system.
Questions. I feel like I've picked your brain pretty
I've told
thoroughly.
You everything. There's nothing left to say.
I do just want to say thank you, though, because although I just think it's very important because I would have never been able to imagine that I would have the opportunity to sit down and talk to you.
Mm.
And it's so, it for me, it feels a lot like an honor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for saying that. It's very kind of you. It doesn't feel, you know, like it should be an honor for you to talk to me, but thank you for feeling that way.
Yeah. And I just think that your perspective is just really important because the industry is continuing to change. It always will. It always has. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were involved in a big shift at that time with Arcade. And,
yeah. It was, I'm certainly grateful. So much of it was just being at the right place at the right time. I think as it is frequently with people who, you know, or are in a situation where they've done something to be remembered for. It's just really just luck in a way.
Yeah.
But I'm very grateful to have had that opportunity. And yes, it is a little strange still to have the attention, you know, lavished on me for something I did so long ago. But it's very gratifying, and I'm grateful.
Are you working on anything now?
I still do consulting and software consulting. And lately I've been doing some work for Sony, doing trophies for their old PS2 games on the PS4, adding trophies. So it's interesting, really interesting work, because I call it forensic computing, because I don't have the source code. So I have assembly code, and sometimes I have a symbol map, a symbol table, and from that I have to figure out how to detect something happening in the game. And I've become quite good at it, and it was a challenge at first, you know, because first of all, it's an assembly language that I'd never used. It's in MIPS. The PS2 uses MIPS, and I'd never coded in MIPS, so I had to learn that assembly language. So going back to an assembly language after all these years was fun and exciting, and
yeah.
And again, just it really is like a puzzle, like doing detective work. You know, what is this function doing? How can I get in? You know, where is this? Where's the score stored? If I want to detect a certain score or a certain level, how do I do that?
Yeah, you're just like dissecting the code.
That's right. That's right. And it's been very fun.
Acting? I know you've been an actor. I mean, you've mm-hmm. you played in quite a few shows: Criminal Minds, ER.
Mm.
What were some other ones?
The Middle,
yeah.
Young and the Restless, General Hospital, LAX,
House.
That's true. Had a scene with LL Cool J. LL Cool J was right up in my face and on House, right?
Are you going to be in anything soon, or are you, you know?
No, not at this point. I do not know. There's a play that I might be doing later this year, but
okay.
I'm not entirely sure yet. And I also do sound design for theater, and there's a sound design I'm doing for a play called The 39 Steps.
Okay.
In Los Angeles. That's being done by the Actors Co-op, a fantastic theater company. They do great work. And so I'm looking forward to that. In fact, I'll get started on that as soon as I get back to L.A.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
I'm probably going to pick your brain for acting.
Oh, sure.
All right. So that was this week's episode of Cake Bites. Thank you all so much for taking the time to listen. I had such a great time sitting down and talking to Warren, and I'm really happy I got to share that with all of y'all. I've got some pretty cool audio. It's not the most quality, but I got to sit down with Warren Davis and John Newcomer, among other people, and they let me record the conversation. And that includes a guest appearance by Randy Pitchford, who was from Gearbox, is the current CEO of Gearbox. That came because he really wanted to come and take the time to sit with Warren and John together. So I'll be editing the audio from that experience I got to have, and I'll be posting that for my patrons on Patreon. And I'm going to take this time to say thank you and welcome to my newest patron, Jonathan. I'm really excited to add you to the small list of patrons at the moment, but thank you so much for supporting the show. It means the world to me. You can find Cake Bites on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and please be sure to subscribe and review the show wherever you're listening to it at. I believe that the show is on most podcast directories, so hopefully you can find the show. If you can't, please let me know, and I will do my best to get the show on your preferred app. I'll see you guys next week.